And after the rave, we're all driving home. And the friend that took us said, you know what, can you drive? And I said, yeah, I'll drive home. And everybody fell asleep. Even I fell asleep.
This is the Dor McKellen Podcast. And our guest this week is Genaro Nava. Rejects, outcasts, freaks. Those were the people that Genaro gravitated to, because he himself was one. Hatred towards his father ran through his veins, and his escape was drugs and alcohol. Hiding his pain behind a persona wasn't working, but it was all he knew to do. It wasn't until a question was presented to him. If you were to die today, where would you spend eternity? This question haunted him on the inside, until finally Genaro stepped into a small church for the first time. A reject, an outcast, a freak, a broken man. This is the story of Genaro Nava. Tell us about how you grew up. Was it in a religious home? Did you maybe witness abusive parents growing up? Was it normal? Can you explain that?
I would say a little bit of both. Maybe religious and normal. Maybe not abusive, but my father was an alcoholic, and I think one of the things I saw as normal was him going to party the whole weekend and not coming back till maybe Monday morning just to show up to work. So to me, that was normal. Now, I know now that that's not normal. That's not the father I want to be to my children. And I tell my children this all the time, every time I have a conversation with them, that my father and I had maybe 10 conversations that I can remember throughout the whole time that he was there, part of the home.
Your father, he actually walked out on your family. I believe you're about 11 years old, later went on to divorce your mother. But tell me, how did that affect you at that age? Now you're saying here he only had about 10 conversations with you, and then now you're 11 and he's walking out. How did that affect you?
You know, that was a deep emotional scar in my life. Not knowing who my father really could be, or him not playing a huge part in my life, was a big thing in me, because I didn't know how to be a man. I didn't know how to act like a man. I didn't know how to grow up. You know, you're going through 11 to 12 to 13, those teenage years where you need somebody, you need some kind of direction in your life, and I didn't have that. So that was a really deep wound, I believe, as growing up in the home. And my mom just couldn't, she worked too much. She couldn't replace my father. She couldn't be a father and a mother. They you know, that can't happen.
Right. Having to now be a single mom and support you and your siblings, right? Having to work those hours, and it's pretty crazy. You know, so that happened at 11. And like you mentioned, now you're growing up, trying to become a young man here, and you have no reference. Did you grow in that time, right, in the adolescent into teenage years, did you get a hatred for your father, or you kind of just blew it off, even though it hurt you, you never wanted to really think about that?
No, there was a hatred. I said, I'm never going to be like my father. I hated the man. I never wanted to see him. And he was fine with that. You know, he really never really saw us. He really didn't call. He didn't visit. I think I remember once my sister and I visited him for a whole week. It was a spring break. And that was the only time I remember visiting him as a teenager. But other than that, he was really non-existent. So there was a deep hatred toward him.
And that's crazy. So you're growing up, you become a teenager, you're in middle school, you're entering high school. This hatred is growing inside of you. You're in high school, and maybe some people don't know, but you actually took on this persona. You were what they would call a goth. You would dress up in all black makeup, or right, in all black clothing. Why did you gravitate to that?
You know, that goth style or persona that you're talking about, you know, back in the day, it wasn't known as goth. Right now, I think we label it as goth, but back then was the freaks. And, you know, the freaks were more of a misfits, where you didn't fit in with anybody. And it's a whole culture. It's a whole spirit. It comes with the music. You like music that it's angry, that makes you feel good. I gravitated to Nine Inch Nails, Marilyn Manson, all these groups that talked about hatred, talked about hurting yourself. And this was the thing that I guess was my refuge in high school, going toward this style, this culture, this spirit there in high school.
And so you have this hatred towards your father. You're gravitating to this style, this lifestyle. Was there also rejection and insecurity that was mixed in there, that it seems like it kind of follows people that have that kind of broken home? And did you experience that, and how did that play out in your life as far as feeling rejected all the time?
Yeah, that deep rejection happened when my father left us. And as a child, people of divorced parents, I'm sure, feel the same way, that you're thinking maybe you could have done something different. I know my sister felt the same way. It was our fault. Maybe we didn't behave. Maybe we didn't, you know, why did he leave us when, you know, our parents had their own struggles, had their own problems that they were going through. And that really, really impacted the way I grew up, how I saw life. And like speaking about this goth style, culture and spirit, I gravitated toward that because, like you said, it was the rejects, people that are not accepted anywhere else, don't fit in. And this lifestyle really, anybody can fit in.
Anybody that's been rejected is accepted in this lifestyle. So you're in high school, you're in this goth persona. At the time, it didn't have that name, right? But you're also, even though you're part of the rejects, you're living that party lifestyle. Was that included the drugs, right? Alcohol? Or why did you choose to do that versus going home and crying yourself to sleep every night?
Well, that was an outlet. You know, drugs, alcohol, they're always an outlet. They're not the solution. You're trying to drown your feelings. And a lot of people in the goth movement, they cut themselves, they want that kind of attention, they like the hurt, they like hurting themselves. And me, I really like the music, really like the partying lifestyle, just didn't want to remember who I was and this hatred that I had in my heart. I tried to drown it out with drugs and alcohol and just the party life.
Right. Did you ever think about or actually cut yourself?
Not really. I wasn't much of a cutter. I wasn't much of pain. I really don't like pain till this day. My wife can attest to that. I don't like pain. So no, not cutting. No, I had no piercings, tattoos, but not piercings, not cuttings. No.
So this is in high school. You have this sense of rejection, but also this massive sense of hatred towards your father. You're accepted with these other rejects. You're living the party lifestyle. Was there an event in that time in high school or situation that happened to you that made you think twice about the life you're living?
Yes, there was. There was. I remember this car accident we had, and my friends and I drove. Well, we were at a rave here in McAllen, and you know, it's underground. A few people know about the rave, and there's drugs. There's a lot of crazy things happening within that rave. And somebody said, you know what, there's another rave that my friend knows about at the beach. You want to go? So, you know, we go with this another guy there. He invites us. We go over there. The other rave, it's even crazier. And after the rave, we're all driving home. And the friend that took us said, you know what, can you drive? And I said, yeah, I'll drive. I'll drive home. And everybody fell asleep. Even I fell asleep at the wheel. I fell asleep at the wheel. And so when I woke up, my friend woke everybody up. He said, it's super cold. All the windows were broken. We were in the side of the road. We had flipped over. We didn't know. This 18-wheeler pulled up and said, you know, you guys need help. You guys flipped over. And we had no idea. We were on drugs. We didn't remember what had happened, but nothing really happened to us. The car was totaled. It was all broken in, crushed in, but we all survived. And after that incident, we went to jail. We went to jail too. Yeah, we went to jail. They took us in for PI, public intoxication, which makes no sense, but they towed the car And during that jail time, it opened up my eyes. Two things. One, you really don't have friends. I called all my friends to bail me out. Nobody.
No answer. And no. They answered no money.
Yeah, no money. Even called the teacher. One of my teachers, which was pretty close to me, I called her and said, you know, ma'am, can you help? Can you help me? I need some money to get a bailed out. She said, no, I don't do that for students. And of course, I didn't call my mother. I did call my mother to let her know I was staying at a friend's house. She never knew I went to jail. I was gone for 3 days. I think that let us go on Monday. So till this day, my mother doesn't know I went to jail.
Well, now she's going to know.
Yes, she is.
And so you said there was two things. That was one thing, that you had no friends. What was the other?
And the second thing was that loneliness in jail. Feeling alone and feeling like, is this what life is all about? There has to be more than just this. And so that really made me think about just my life and where I was going. And is change really possible?
So this was in high school, and you've already began to kind of, what am I going to do with my life? You've come to that point. So your dad abandoned you guys around 88 or 89. This one, you're around 11 years old. And about 8 years later, you walk into our church here in McAllen in about, I believe it was 1996. How did you hear about us, and did you immediately lock in?
I was at the movies, and leaving the movies, a friend of mine, my friend and I were leaving the movies, and the church is out there, the door. The door church is out there. They're witnessing to people. They're, you know, they go give you a flyer, start talking to you, and start, you know, bullying you into salvation. That's what it seems like. I see them all, you know, you can see them all, and you're like, oh man, they're going to come over here. How do I ignore them? Right. So they come to me, and they come to my friend, and my friend's super close. They come to me, and I'm trying to be super close too, so they won't continue bothering me.
Let me stop you right there. So did you try to maybe, did you think about scaring them away with how you were dressed back then, or you're like, they got me?
No, I think they're just going free for all. You know, they're going for everybody. You know how we do it in church. You just go, and whoever's out there, doesn't matter how they look, you're going to go talk to them.
If they breathe, you're going to go witness to them.
Exactly. So somebody goes up to me and starts talking to me about salvation. And he asked me the question, the infamous question that we ask all sinners, right? If you died today, where would you go? And I said, I don't know. And he starts talking. I don't recall anything, but that question did stay in my mind. I know we ask people all the time, right? And we think, do they really think about it? Well, I thought about it. I took his flyer, you know, I was closed. He left. And that flyer, I put it up on my wall. I don't know why. I just put it up on my wall. I have my room was full of posters, full of flyers.
I think at the time, around in 96, I think that was what was in, having
maybe
your wall,
yeah, full
floor
of
to ceiling, just any poster, any sticker.
Yeah, that's what it was. So I put the flyer there. And maybe months later, my sister invited me to church. She said, you know what? I think you need to go to church. And I was like, nah, I don't need to. She's like, you know what? You're going to like this church. She's like, it's called The Door. And I went to my room and I got the flyer of this church. And she said, yes, that's the church. That's the church. I was like, you know what? I'm going to go. I felt like it was a sign or something, you know, that it was that church.
Let me stop you really quick. How long was she already going to the church, or was she herself still a new convert and just wanted to invite you?
She was a new convert. She was invited by her mother-in-law. Had just invited her, so it was a new thing for her, because I don't remember her ever going to church. So she invites me to church, and so I go. I felt like it was a sign. I went to church, and it wasn't an immediate thing, because I went once, and then I didn't go back maybe for a month or two, or maybe a month. And we're going right after Halloween, because they were talking about, I think a new pastor was there, or you are doing a transition, something like that, and people were crying. Something like that. So it was probably after conference.
Right.
That's what it seemed
so
like.
They it had sounds like it's October
yeah,
time.
Yeah, it's October time. So and they were talking about some kind of haunted house or something like that, you know. So it was, the details are kind of vague, but that's what I remember. They didn't go back till November, because that's when I got saved, November 3rd, 1996.
And tell us about that. Tell us about your conversion.
I was the first time I went to go check it out. I thought it was a sign. I went and you know what? Okay, just go. You go to church, you visit. That's it. I'm like, okay, I did it.
Wait, I went to church. Just I have this question right now. Did you go to church in all black, wearing makeup, or you kind of yes. said, let me at least?
No. That's who I am. That's just who I was. The shock and awe. That's actually what I was into. And you know, I was. My high school was in La Jolla, and really nobody in La Jolla did the goth thing. So I was me and a couple of friends, or just probably just me. I'm serious. And I would go all out. So going back to the church, yes, I did go like that, because I remember later on after being saved, people were saying, man, I was so scared of you. I didn't want to shake your hand during the the meet and greet part.
You can't blame them.
I could not blame them. So I go in before, after your conference, that first church service I attended, and then I go back on November 3rd. And that's when I really made a commitment. I went to the altar and I didn't raise my hand. You know, they call Christians. So I just went to the altar. I'm like, I'm going to go pray. And then somebody goes and talks to me and prays with me for salvation. And the person that prayed for me, it's interesting, was the same person that witnessed to me the very first time. I know. I'm very, very fond of that gentleman.
Wow. And it looks like, you know, God was trying to reach you even before that, you know, movie time where he spared your life in that accident. And then here you are walking out of the movies, and then this guy's kind of like, hey, you know, where would you go? And you're like, eh, whatever. You come to November 3rd, and this guy's praying with you now. You know, God really did have a plan for your life. So did, you know, you went home after that. How did your lifestyle change? Did you take down the posters? You threw away the black clothing? What happened?
I think it was a gradual change, or outward was more gradual than the inward. Mm. The inward change was immediate. I didn't want nothing to do with the old life. Stopped doing drugs. I came in with a girlfriend at the time, and she wasn't into it. She's like, I'll support you. You can go to church. And she would come a couple of times to church, but she wasn't into it at all. She still wanted to party. She still wanted to do her, you know, the things we were doing. And
right.
We parted ways. Reported ways in the very beginning. That's one of the main things. I remember her going to a fellowship. This is amazing about the church. It's December. I get saved in November, and they invite me to a fellowship. And December is my birthday's in December, and they have this fellowship, and they make it into a birthday party for me. This is a new convert, you know, and I bring in my girlfriend, and we're both really weird looking, goth looking, and so they make this party for me, and it really felt special. It really, really like, wow, these people actually care. Why would they throw a party? They just met me. You know, I remember my girlfriend having some pictures. She loved to take pictures, and there were some weird pictures. And she was passing them around the room, and people were like, oh, that's so nice. I'm thinking, yeah, whatever. But that's just the power of the church, you know, very receiving, making you feel comfortable, even though you might be weird or the way you grew up or whatever, they just receive it just the way you are. That really made an impact on me.
So you're saved, you know, you begin to make these changes, even though, like you said, the outward was gradual, inside you were, this is what I'm going to do for the rest of my life. From a goth who wore all black and white makeup, now you're, fast forward, you're in a tie serving in church. When did you feel God first calling you to preach? Can you explain that?
You know, right before going to my first conference, God was already speaking to me about the call. And people would tell you, well, it's evident you're called. I'm thinking, I'm not called. I don't feel it. I don't even know what it is to be called. So many people were called in the church. There was this discipleship atmosphere in McAllen back. It's still here. It's still here. It's always been there. And so I remember people telling me, you're called, but I didn't feel it. It wasn't until I attended my first conference, my first October conference, that I remember somebody giving the call who's called to preach, and I felt God called me. That you are, I'm calling you to preach. I'm calling you to preach to the nations, and you know, you would get up, go to the altar, and raise up your hand that you're called, and that was a sign that you're into this, so this is your calling.
Well, and you took that and you really, you accepted that. You know, some people are like, oh, I don't know, but you said, you know what, God, you are calling me. So you have this goal in life and you end up, you know, eventually marrying your wife, Melody, you know, in the church. Once you got married, did you guys immediately start contending to get sent out of your church, or did you kind of go through some roadblocks?
You know, there were some roadblocks. We knew what we wanted to do. She married me knowing that I wanted to be a pastor, and I knew she wanted to be a pastor's wife. But we come from different backgrounds, and when I mean different backgrounds, very, very different backgrounds, baggage. And as soon as we got married, everything came out, of course. It happens, right? Two single people getting married, and all these things came out in our marriage. And in the very beginning of our marriage, maybe before the first year, I would say, my wife had backslid. My wife had backslid. She wasn't into it. She would go to church sometimes, not go to church. And so I felt that my calling was going to be held back. You know, I felt like, okay, well, I didn't know what to do. I really felt like stuck. Okay, like she's not into it anymore. I don't know what's going to happen. And it wasn't until she committed her life to Jesus again.
Well, did you, in that time, did you consider yourself maybe saying, you know what, maybe I should kind of let go of this and focus on her and not so much the church? Did you think about quitting?
I didn't think about quitting. I knew I had to be a husband. And I had to put her first. And that's the whole thing I did with my wife. I said, you know what? You're first. Our marriage is first. And I knew God had called me. But I needed to take care of my wife right now in this crucial moment of time. I needed to be there for her. And she can attest to this, that made an impact on her, because she eventually did come back to church. She eventually did get saved again. And it wasn't until, you know, they give so many callings in church, who's called to preach, and you would bring your wife to the altar. Well, I wasn't doing that anymore. I couldn't do that because I knew she wasn't into it. And it wasn't until one calling that they made, and she grabbed my hand and she said, let's go. I'm called. And I knew that she was back.
Wow. And What was going on in your mind when that happened? And even after the altar call, what did you feel?
Well, I felt it was a confirmation that God redeemed her, God touched her again. She wants to do God's will again.
That's incredible. You know, God is able to work with all of us, any of us. You know, as long as, like, you know what, God, I've made some mistakes. I've had some hiccups here and there, but God is always able and willing to work with us. So maybe it was like a year later, right? And now both of you are all in. You're ready to serve. You're ready to commit yourselves, getting ready to go out and preach. This is around, I think, 2000 or 2001. You guys didn't pastor your first church until 2009. Were those 9, 10 years, 8 years, were those full of preparation or setbacks?
A little bit of both, I believe. Preparation and setbacks. Because my wife had come back from her backsliding, but there was still a long road ahead in our marriage. There were some things we both had to work, and then complacency sets in, where you just get comfortable in church and you're not contending anymore. Yes, you're a disciple. Yes, you're doing a Bible study. Yes, you're leading an outreach. You're doing everything a disciple does, but that complacency set in. I had a good job. And so preparation, setbacks, both things played a part.
Well, it was there a point where you woke up, something happened to you guys or you, that God kind of woke you up and said, hey, you're comfortable right now, but I didn't call you to be comfortable. I called you to preach.
Yeah, there was a rude awakening where I lost my job and it wasn't my fault. And so I get another job, but it made me think, because it was a very good job. I was making good money in that job, and they let me go, and it wasn't my fault. And so I was thinking, maybe God doesn't want me to get comfortable. God doesn't want me stuck here. he wants me to go out. So that really opened my eyes. And when I felt that, there was some things happening where God was supernaturally moving in my life. And my pastor at the time saw that. And he said, I can't deny it. There's a move of, there's something happening in your life that's moving. I need to send you out. You've been here long enough. You know how to do everything.
So that's 2009. 2009 comes around. You've been in the church 12 years. You guys, I think by now, have your two children, right?
Yes, we do.
So it's 2009. You pastor your first church. Can you tell us how your experience has been from then until now in all the cities you've pastored? You've pastored a couple of cities now. Can you tell us how your experience has been?
It's been an awesome experience. I can say this to all the pioneers. The ups and downs are all worth it, from our first church, from our all those mistakes you do at the very beginning. You know, I wasn't door director when I got sent out. And so you go to, and pioneer your first church, and there's a lot of rookie mistakes that I made, and where my pastor would rebuke me and tell me, no, this is not what you do. This is you did it wrong. You have to do it this way. You have to do it this way. And I'm thinking, well, I didn't learn it. That's why I'm thinking to myself, I'm not telling that to my pastor. I didn't learn it. That's the reason I'm making these mistakes out here. And so there's this learning curve, right? In doing your first church, you live, you learn, you destroy some converts, unfortunately, because you're just so new at it. And then from there, we went to Brazil. We became missionaries.
And that was in 2013, correct?
That's correct. Yeah, just going to Brazil was crazy in itself, because I didn't think I didn't think I was capable of going to Brazil or qualified. That's the word I'm looking for.
Right. I'm sure when this was presented to you, what ran through your head when they said, hey, you know, we want to send a church in Brazil and we think you're the couple that can do that?
Well, pastor had been announcing it, I think, or had been talking about it. I did not think it was us. Or maybe not think it was us. I didn't want it to be us. I didn't feel a calling to be a missionary. I'm fine here. I'm having revival in Edinburgh. You know, we're off support. We're good. We're good right now, you know. And so when there wasn't really a calling for us, it was during conference, I believe the day before we're going to be announced to Brazil. That's when pastor calls us and to the office. You know, you get the tap. When I got the tap, my wife tells me that whatever you decide to do, I'm gonna be with you, and which is powerful, because she had a dream, or no, not a dream. She had a God spoken to her and tell her to let go of Edinburgh. That was the city we're pioneering. So when the tap happened, she said, "Whatever you want to do, I'm going to be with you." And I said, "Well, whatever they offer me, I'm going to say yes." She's like, "Yes to what?" And right before even that happened, this all happened during conference. I had a dream where I was preaching in Brazil, and millions of people were getting saved.
And how did you know it was Brazil? You just, you know, by the environment. Was there a flag, or how did?
I think I knew it was Brazil because pastor was talking about Brazil. So I knew it was Brazil. So I had that dream, and then my wife had that confirmation. And so when he called us, we said yes.
You said yes. In 2013, you guys go and you arrive. What did you experience now? You're in a completely different nation, completely different language, completely different culture. How was that for you guys?
That was really, really a great experience, with all the good and all that bad that happened over there. And just to take all that in, the not knowing what they're talking about when you first get there. You know, we get to Brazil and our baggages or our suitcases get lost. So I'm trying to speak to somebody and they don't speak English. Of course, I can understand what they're saying. So I'm frustrated. I'm like, I don't know what to do. I don't know what to do here. And some lady that knows English, she hears it. And she says, you know what, I can help you. Let me give them, I didn't have a number. They needed a number, so she gave them her number. I didn't have an address. I didn't know where I was staying at.
Fresh missionaries.
So, yeah, so she gives them her address, and then she knows where we're at, the hotel, and she personally goes, delivers the suitcases to our hotel, and she gets saved. You know, so right in the very beginning, I knew God was going to take care of us. you know, with all those things happening, she gets saved. She's helping us around town, just moving us and telling us about the city. And so through every obstacle there in Brazil, we had that comfort that God was going to be with us through every single step, opening doors, supernatural doors that only he can do.
So that was 2013. You're in Brazil for 5 years, and you guys came back to the States. You're pastoring now in Brownsville, Texas. You were able to take over that church. From 2009 until now, did you ever, maybe more than once, but did you ever second guess your calling?
I don't think I second guessed my calling, but through those difficult times, you second guess if God's going to pull you out again. Mm. I think that's what you do. Not really the calling, because I know what I'm called for. I knew this is where God wants me. One thing I always told my family, I will never say no to the will of God. Wherever God wants me, that's where I want to be at, because that's where I'm going to be the happiest, the more fulfilled. And so maybe not the calling, but just doubting, okay, God, are you going to pull me out of this one? You know, even though sometimes it's our fault, we get in our own situations and thinking, okay, God, I messed up. Are you still going to pull me out of this one? So maybe just second guessing God sometimes, but not my calling.
You've been saved for 24 years. You've pastored 3 churches now. You're happily married to your wife, and your children are saved and serving in the church. You're seeing major breakthrough right now in Brownsville. What can you say helped you the most, or what can you point to that made you stick it out all these years?
You know, I believe it's keeping my heart right. The Bible says to guard your heart, because everything flows from the issues of the heart. And I believe through everything that we've gone through in our ministry, in our marriage, it was really keeping our heart right. You know, in the very beginning of our marriage, I told you my wife backslid, and keeping my heart right, saying, God, you know what? You saw this marriage happen in church, and I'm not going to have any hatred towards my wife. I'm going to forgive this trespass. And it really did something. Forgiving my father. I mentioned the very beginning, I had this hatred toward my father, and calling my father after being saved. And I remember being a sermon somebody, my pastor had preached about forgiving others. And I call my father and I tell him I'm sorry that I've had this hatred toward him. And he's freaking out. He's like, what? You have hatred toward me? He's like, what are you talking about? He's like, yes, you know, I want you to forgive me. He just didn't know what to say. He's like, I felt like I have to ask for forgiveness from you. He said, no, I have to ask forgiveness from you. You know, and after that, now we have a relationship, not a great relationship, but we have a relationship. But just forgiving my father, there in Brazil, the evangelist, Larry Beauregard, who did a revival, and he was talking about being saved. I believe he said for 50 years or 45 years. I don't know. It was a long time. He remembers having a revival in Tucson and being him, Pastor, and Mona, and the evangelist, the only people in church. And he's telling me, he has so many great stories. And one of the things that stood out, he said, is keeping your heart right throughout all these years. He said that has helped him. And I believe that's what has helped me too. You know, my wife had her wedding ring stolen at a baby shower that she threw for somebody in church. It was all church people. And it was stolen, and she forgave. You know, we both forgave. We let that go. We went to court. It was a huge thing at in the church. We had gone to court with people in church. So I had very, very good friends of mine leave the church. All these things. I've had disputes, and just keeping my heart right throughout all these years, I believe, has made me fruitful. There's a spiritual dimension when you keep your heart right and not hold these things in your heart and let it affect your life.
Today, Renato is faithfully pastoring his church in Brownsville, Texas, with his wife and children. The best is yet to come for the Nava family. And if you're wondering, the first church he started in Edinburgh and his second in Belo Horizonte, Brazil, they are still operating to this day. Actually, all 3 churches are seeing revival and major breakthrough. It's amazing what God can do
with what the world rejects. If you know of someone who is going through a similar situation, please share this podcast and see what God can do through a testimony. I'm Beto Rivas. Thanks for listening. This is the Dor McAllen Podcast.